Today is Tuesday, December 22, and you're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinedu Ofor, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Coming up, COVID-19 shuts down Britain.
Cut off from much of Europe, chaos at major ports. Britain has been effectively quarantined by its neighbors.
Also ahead, the U.S. Congress approves $900 billion pandemic relief package.
And Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin on Monday said Americans could begin seeing stimulus payments as soon as next week.
Plus, conditions are worsening for refugees at the Ethiopia and Sudan border. These stories and more are next. Our top story today is in Britain, where over 40 countries have imposed travel bans on people arriving from Britain after the government announced last week it had detected a new, more contagious strain of the coronavirus. The European Commission on Tuesday recommended that member states ease their total bans on UK travel and freight movement. However, EU states control their borders and can ignore the Commission's recommendations. As Henry Ridgewell reports from London, the travel restrictions have caused major disruptions as Britain struggles to contain its latest outbreak.
Cut off from much of Europe, chaos at major ports. Britain has been effectively quarantined by its neighbours. Dozens of countries elsewhere have banned travel to and from the country, including India, Canada and Russia. Britain's Prime Minister said Monday the government was trying to persuade European allies to end the blockade.
We in the UK fully understand the anxieties of our friends about COVID, their anxieties about the new variant. But it's also true that we believe the risks of transmission by a solitary driver sitting alone in the cab are really very low. And so we hope to make progress as fast as we possibly can.
The restrictions are being felt most acutely at Dover. Around 10,000 trucks use the rail and ferry crossing to the French port of Calais every day. Among those stranded is Polish trucker Stanislav Olbrich.
I have three children and wife, and they need me to come for Christmas. Christmas in Poland is a very special holiday. It's bind with religion and traditional. It's for Polish people, it's very hard to be away on Christmas. So this situation cost me very hard.
British exports are directly affected, while imports could be hit if European drivers refuse to travel. British supermarkets have warned of possible shortages. Britain announced late last week that it had identified a mutant strain of the coronavirus, which is 70% more transmissible. That prompted other countries to impose travel bans. A European Union-wide response is expected Tuesday. Hugo de Jonge is the Netherlands health minister. He said the current flight ban has been taken as a precaution. Other restrictions on other travel options from the United Kingdom are currently being considered.
The current flight ban has been taken as a precaution. Other restrictions on other travel options from the United Kingdom are currently being considered.
Meanwhile, over 16 million people in southern Britain, including London, have been put in the highest lockdown tier, with household mixing and non-essential travel prohibited. Kylie Nichols lives in the capital.
I think that the new strain of the virus is definitely concerning, and I think it is the right decision, but I just wish it would have been made a few days earlier.
Scientists say the new variant of the virus makes the rollout of vaccines even more critical. Over 500,000 Britons have now received their first dose of the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine. Meanwhile, it's just days before Britain is due to leave the Brexit transition period on January 1st, with no trade deal yet agreed. Deal or no deal, Britain's EU exit is predicted to cause further trade and travel disruption. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
As the US rolls out the coronavirus vaccines, President-elect Joe Biden rolled up his sleeve in his home state of Delaware to receive his first shot in a live broadcast. Associated Press correspondent Jackie Quinn reports.
I'm ready.
The president-elect received the first of two doses of Pfizer's vaccine at a hospital not far from his Delaware home.
There's great hope. I'm doing this to demonstrate that people should be prepared when it's available to take the vaccine.
He declined the nurse practitioner's offer to count to three before he took the jab in his left arm.
No, you just go ahead anytime you're ready.
Biden emphasized the safety of the vaccine and gave the Trump administration some credit for starting the distribution process. He warns, though, it will be months before everyone can get a shot. He urges people not to travel and wear a mask over the holiday season. Some members of Congress have already received their vaccinations. Jackie Quinn, Washington.
Israel plans to vaccinate 2 million of its citizens by the end of January, but some Palestinians say they have been left out. For more, VOA's Jason Patinkin reached out to journalist Linda Grantstein in Jerusalem.
Well, Israel this week started vaccinating its population. In the first 2 days, there were 30,000 people vaccinated, and the idea is to vaccinate 2 million people out by the end of January. Now, the total population of Israel is 9 million, but approximately 3 million are either under 16 and who will not be vaccinated now or have already had corona. So that means that basically a third of the population will be vaccinated in the next month. And Israel can do this because Israel has socialized medicine, and so you have to join an HMO. So they've been actually able to roll it out very quickly, and they're going to be giving, they're giving so far the Pfizer vaccine, but it will also be giving the Moderna vaccine, and it's obviously two doses. So people are getting the first dose now. Anyone over 60 has already been able to sign up for an appointment, and they've been so far pretty successful in rolling out their vaccination program.
Now, that's for Israeli citizens, but of course, there's also the Palestinian territories. What about Palestinian folks? Where do they fall in terms of this plan?
So when it comes to the Palestinians, it's a little bit more complicated. First of all, there are about 3 million Palestinians in the West Bank and another 2 million Palestinians in Gaza. Gaza is especially complicated because there's only electricity for 8 or 10 hours a day. And the Pfizer vaccine, for example, has to be kept very, very cold. Now, Israeli officials have said that the West Bank is not part of Israel, that they don't have any legal obligation to provide the vaccine. But if they have extra, they will certainly give it to the Palestinians. The Palestinians are also hoping that they can get it through this special program that's being run by the World Health Organization for places that don't have the vaccine. The vaccine is also fairly expensive for the Palestinians. Now, I did hear an interview with the head of one of the Israeli hospitals yesterday who said that he believes that Israel has a responsibility to provide the vaccine to the Palestinians. Russia has also said that they are interested in providing the vaccine. But in any case, it's probably going to take at least several months longer than it is in Israel. And the complication then becomes there are hundreds of thousands of Palestinians who come to Israel to work. So if you have an Israeli population that is basically vaccinated and a Palestinian population that is not vaccinated, that will be potentially difficult for Israel as well as for the Palestinians.
That was journalist Linda Grantstein in Jerusalem speaking to my VOA colleague Jason Patinkin in Washington. With the world embarking on a campaign to deliver super-cold vaccines to remote parts of the globe, lessons can be learned from the Democratic Republic of Congo, where a thermos-like device was developed to tackle Ebola. David Doyle of Reuters reports.
As the world embarks on an unprecedented campaign to bring vaccines to millions, often in remote locations, vital lessons can be learned from the Democratic Republic of Congo. In 2018, during an outbreak of Ebola, health officials here needed to deploy an experimental vaccine that had to be kept at between minus 60 and minus 80 degrees Celsius. They did that with the ArcTech device, effectively a giant thermos that can be filled with vaccines and special ice packs. Global Health Labs, which helped design ArcTech, is currently retuning the device for use with dry ice so that each unit could keep up to 1,500 doses of Pfizer-BioNTech's vaccine frozen for several weeks. GHL's Daniel Lieberman.
If we're dealing with cryogenic vaccines like the Pfizer one, currently requires minus 80, we can put dry ice in the ArcTech and use it for that. if somebody would like to use the Moderna vaccine, you can get a phase change material at minus 20, and you can store the Moderna vaccine.
Africa has so far been spared the worst of the pandemic, but a second wave of infections is currently hitting Western Central Africa. Experts warn cooler weather could make it worse, focusing minds on vaccination. Between 2018 and 2020, health workers inoculated more than 400,000 people against Ebola, lugging vials colder than an Antarctic winter through equatorial forests. When cars could not pass the mud-clogged roads, they drove motorbikes. If water was the only option, canoes. The remote locations were not the only problem, as Ture Elefan, a vaccine expert at the World Health Organization, explains.
For example, in Africa, they used to say that we just used to make the vaccine to exterminate the African people, or the vaccine will make the men weaken, or it will make the women infertile.
He says that a communication strategy needs to be in place before the vaccines are distributed. Without public trust, advances in cold chain technology may do little to save lives.
That was David Doyle of Reuters. This is the Voice of America. Senior White House advisor Jared Kushner is leading a delegation from Israel to Morocco. Joined by Israel's national security advisor, he departed Tuesday on the first direct commercial flight between the two countries. The flight marks the establishment of full diplomatic ties earlier this month as part of a series of U.S. brokered normalization accords between Israel and Arab countries. When Morocco normalized ties with Israel, the United States recognized Morocco's claim to the disputed Western Sahara region, sparking domestic and international outcry. The United Nations says the Western Sahara dispute should be decided by a referendum of the region's residents. Official crime figures show around 1,000 children are murdered every year in South Africa, nearly three a day. But that statistic may be an undercount. Child welfare experts say many more children are victims of homicides that are not investigated properly, not prosecuted, or are completely missed by authorities. Nationwide child death reviews, regular in many developed countries, are not common in South Africa. You are listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinedu Ofor, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. In a much-delayed attempt to help Americans get through the economic effects of the world's largest outbreak, the U.S. Congress finally passed a new $900 billion COVID relief bill after months of debate. AP correspondent Julie Walker reports.
The bill includes a one-time direct payment of $600 to Americans who earn less than $75,000, $300 weekly unemployment checks, aid to businesses, and resources to vaccinate the nation. What it doesn't include is funding cities and states wanted. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer.
It's not as large as Democrats want. It's certainly larger than what many Republicans want. That's the nature of compromise.
He says Democrats will work on a new bill under the incoming Biden administration. And Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin on Monday said Americans could begin seeing stimulus payments as soon as next week. I'm Julie Walker.
The huge pandemic relief and spending bill includes billions of dollars to promote clean energy, such as wind and solar power. It also calls for a 15-year reduction in the use of potent coolants in air conditioners and refrigerators that are considered a major driver of global warming. The energy and climate provisions, which lawmakers from both sides supported, are hailed as the most significant climate change law in at least a decade. The legislation also extends tax credits for solar and wind power that are a key part of President-elect Joe Biden's ambitious plan to generate 100% clean electricity by 2035. More than a month after the military conflict in Ethiopia's Tigray region began, conditions are worsening for refugees who fled the fighting into Sudan. As hundreds of refugees continue to cross the border, there are growing safety concerns, fears of food shortages and disease outbreak. VOA's Heather Murdoch is in the Sudanese capital Khartoum after visiting the refugee camps in Sudan. She spoke to me about what she learned in the camps?
Well, there are several flashpoints on the borders between Ethiopia and Sudan. And I say flashpoints, not necessarily places where people are battling, but places where there have been some fights. And there's also places where refugees have been coming over the border for over a month now. We've heard that yesterday 1,000 new people came over the border. And you have to expect that if that many people manage to cross in one day, there's a considerable amount of desperation. Because on the Ethiopia side, we understand that the borders are closed and it's quite dangerous for families to try to leave Ethiopia right now. The border on the Sudan side is open to refugees, but in the past 2 weeks or so, between dozens and sometimes hundreds have made it through, sometimes only a few per day. So it seems like people are fleeing at a faster rate. There's also been, in the past week, there was a cross-border raid by not by the Ethiopian government soldiers, but by militias that crossed the border and killed as many as 4 Sudanese soldiers and damaged property. This attack was a surprise, and it signals higher tensions in the area. And it's not just Sudan and Ethiopia. There's also a border with Eritrea there, and it's a highly militarized zone with bases for all countries.
What is the current security situation in that area?
The border areas have recently been evacuated, or not entirely, but largely refugee families have been asked to leave the border refugee camps and relocated to the camps farther into Sudan. One of the reasons cited is security, although the refugees themselves are told that simply that all of the resources, the food and shelter, are going to be moved or are being moved to the camp further inside Sudan called Umm Rukuba. The borders that have security problems at the moment are tightly controlled, and we could see, as we drove to Khartoum yesterday, we could see truckloads of soldiers leaving Khartoum and heading towards the border areas.
Now, what kind of resources are available to these refugees in terms of food and medicine?
Resources for refugees here are slim, I mean, to put it the best possible way. Sudan is already a poor country, and they are doing as much as one could possibly imagine a country this poor could do for so many refugees at such a short notice. So food and shelter and water and other necessities have all been rerouted to the Umm Rukuba camp. But this week we were meeting new families that had moved from other camps, that had been there 1 day, 2 days, 3 days, even 5 days. Families that had just gotten there, say the night before, hadn't eaten. Other families said that were sick. We met a family that was living with HIV, and they had no special help available to them. And because they're weak, the one thing that is available to refugees right now is drinking water, courtesy of refugees and international organizations. They couldn't even collect the drinking water because they didn't have the strength.
In this period of COVID-19, and other infectious diseases, are there health fears in these refugee camps?
Among refugees, we didn't hear many fears. People just said, we don't have it here. We didn't have it at home. You see aid workers and outsiders coming into the camp wearing masks and sometimes even gloves. Certainly there's a concern from any medical experts that if there was an outbreak of the pandemic in a camp, it would immediately be a disaster because there's no way to social distance. It's almost impossible to keep reasonably clean, let alone have sanitized hands. I mean, people struggle to find enough water to shower during the day, and the area is dusty and crowded. So as of now, there's not a lot of fear, but it is worrying that if the disease does come to the camps, and it could, because the more help people get, the more outsiders arrive at the camps, the more possibility it is that the pandemic comes to the camps, and that could be a disaster.
That's VOA's Heather Murdoch speaking to me from Khartoum. A report released by the Pentagon finds that racial minorities are underrepresented in officer ranks in the U.S. military. The report also says the military needs to do more to address the threat of extremists operating within U.S. military ranks. For more on the report's findings and what the Pentagon says it will do about it, VOA's Jason Patinkin reached out to Jeff Shogol. Shogol is the Pentagon correspondent for the Task and Purpose website, which specializes in covering U.S. military affairs.
This new report that the Pentagon released, what did it find in terms of race, particularly looking at representation?
Its findings were not entirely surprising. It found, for example, that the majority of officers are white. White officers make up a greater proportion of the officer corps than they do of the civilian population. And they made some suggestions about how to fix that. They want to make sure that all officers, regardless of race and ethnicity or gender, are able to take the type of assignments that ultimately lead to them being promoted, like being aide-de-camp. They're looking at possibly making some changes to testing. And also, they're looking to see if when people get evaluated, if there's any inherent bias from the people who are actually writing the evaluations.
Did the report at all shed any light on what the causes might be for why whites are overrepresented in the officer class of the U.S. military?
It's more a statement of the facts as they are, noting that the majority of people who are commissioned are white. They recommended reaching out to institutions such as historically black colleges, Latino studies institutions to try to diversify that pool. But they found that one major issue is that officers who are not white are retained significantly less once they get to a certain level. Retained means they can stay in the military to go on to further their career. The study found that around the rank of major in most of the services or lieutenant commander in the Navy, far fewer Black and Latino and other more diverse officers are allowed to stay in the military. So they're looking at ways to make sure that officers have careers that allow them to go on to more senior leadership positions.
And now I want to turn to the issue of extremism, and this is something that you wrote about on Task and Purpose. What did it find in terms of the presence of extremists who are in the military or have infiltrated the U.S. military?
Well, the answer to your question is we don't know. The data on the subject is sorely lacking. They found that the way of tracking extremists in the military isn't in a uniform format, so the military doesn't know how great the issue is. They noted that the majority of people in the military are fairly young, and that's the group that is most likely to be targeted by extremist views. They also found that the military really needs to take into account the role of social media and other electronic communications when it comes to looking at whether service members are participating in white supremacist groups. Right now, it is not enough for a service member to simply be a member of a white supremacist group to be kicked out. They have to actively participate. And the study said, well, the military really needs to look at whether social media presence will be considered participating.
You mentioned white supremacists. When this report is talking about extremism, is that what they're mostly talking about, far-right white supremacism?
In this case, they are. There was a report after the first Fort Hood shooting, I think in 2009, that addressed other types of radical groups. But this case, they were speaking about white extremism, neo-Nazi groups.
Moving forward, what is the military planning to do, or what does it say needs to be done to root this out, to get a handle on this issue?
Well, in typical military style, they've set deadlines to come up with reports, to come up with recommendations. So nothing quite concrete right now. It's more like they're coming up with a plan to come up with a plan. When it comes to white extremism, the Office of General Counsel is required by the end of July to come up with a legislative proposal to update the military's law system to better counter white extremists. But ultimately, those recommendations need to be approved by someone else. In this case, it would have to be the president to introduce that legislation to Congress.
That's Jeff Shogol, Pentagon correspondent for the Task and Purpose website, speaking to my colleague Jason Patinkin in Washington. That's it for our show today. For more breaking and in-depth news 24 hours a day, please visit voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, our colleague Jason Patinkin, and our managing editor, Kate Pound-Dawson, I am Chinedu Ofor, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Thank you for listening, and have a great evening.